Health Science and Energy Show. Tonight's entitled is "The Doctor Is In, Here Comes the Judge," and I think it's going to be very interesting. David Wynn Miller is considered in the legal field one person not to tangle with, and we're going to, rather than go through a huge introduction, I put his website up. We'll be introducing him momentarily, and also one of his students is going to be on by the name of Monty. So, Judge Miller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Would you please introduce yourself a little bit to the audience? Because you've got such a background in what you do, I wouldn't know where to start. You're more complicated than I am, which is good.
Well, I got into law in 1980, so I've been at it for 26 years now. I've got 68,000 hours of legal research and training in the law. I spent 3 years in 1991 and 92 working covertly with William Rehnquist at the Supreme Court on the mathematical interface on languages. April 6, 1988 is when I, after 3 years of trying, broke the mathematical interface in all 5,000 languages, proving that all 5,000 languages are a linear equation in math, and that my website, when I put it up in English, Spanish, French, German, and Italian, and there's no translation deviation between the languages. We currently have the ability to do 37 different languages by just a keystroke on the computer, and the computer will completely convert one language to another language, and when it's presented to language professors, there is no translation deviation. In other words, if you had an article that was written in English and then translated it to Spanish, and from Spanish to French, and French to German, and German to Latin, and Latin back to English, you wouldn't lose any words, and the meanings would be the same going in as well as coming out. So when they put this to the test over the years, Annette, they found that indeed it does work. I spent 17 years in college, full-time, and I picked up a little bit of information along the way. And that information is knowing where to look. That's the only thing college really teaches you, is know where to look when you have a question. So you go to your dictionaries. And I'm a collector of dictionaries from all over the place. And a unique thing about a dictionary is when you get into a single definition of a word, you're only restricted to that word. But when you look at synonyms, like the word love, for instance, it has 88 synonyms, and when you put together the definition with the 88 synonyms, you get a 6,000-word definition, which, needless to say, you learn about what the emotion of love is through all this research. Same thing is true in law. When we do research in law, we look at the way that they constructed the words, and we break things down through procedures. Now, as a judge, I study procedures. Lawyers study subject matter. And the procedures are very unique because they control all things. When, you know, in America, I'll ask 200 people the question, what is 4 plus 4 divided by 4? And all 200 people will say 2. When I was in Europe last year, I asked 50 people at random on the street, what's the answer to 4 plus 4 divided by 4? And every single one of them said 5. The order of operations is you divide first. 4 divided by 4 is 1, and 1 plus 4 is 5. 5 is the correct answer. If you don't follow procedures in math, you get the wrong answer. If you don't follow procedures in the way you use words, how they connect with each other, you get the wrong definition. Do you know that the United States Codes 1 through 50 do not have one single legal sentence written in them, and that the Internal Revenue Codes do not have a single legal sentence written in them? So, and when we went to school, we learned that a sentence is one idea. If you said, I'm going to the car from the house, well, to is in future tense and from is in past tense. You've got two different time slots in one sentence. And then when you say to the car from the house, you also are not in now time. So therefore, the sentence has no jurisdiction. when
that's all law is. I mean, the law evidently is written with very sloppy English, to just put it lightly.
Well, it's no. You know that the law is written using adverbs, adjectives, pronouns, and verbs. They do not allow prepositional phrases. Now, I'm going to give you all nine words, and these are the nine words that judges and attorneys swear an oath to. And this is what they go to college and learn in 6 years. Everything they write must qualify under these nine words. And those nine words are, no law or fact shall be tried in court. Now, no is an adverb, and an adverb modifies. But this is a negative condition of modification, and a modification is a change. A change is a motion. A motion is an action. So no is an adverb negative, makes it a negative law verb, a negative fact verb.
That's correct. It means there is no law.
Yes, but by your own confession, there is no law. There is an adverb making is a verb. No is an adverb making law a verb. And through usury, through your own plausible deniability to make that statement, you just gave no law credibility under usury, and therefore the no condition of law now becomes a fact. And because you made it a fact, the entire United States codes, entire IRS codes now become usury fact, and they can prosecute you for it. By your own confession.
Wow, yeah.
You know that 25 million people in America are on probation and 3.8 million are sitting in prison because they confessed and then signed up to volunteer to go to jail to be fed, housed, clothed, and work for their 10 cents an hour.
That's amazing. And I know that you've been in court many times and the judges, I mean, they just throw things out when you walk in because you start to define things.
Right. As soon as you break down the fact.
We talked about President Clinton, what you were doing with him, with the definition of is. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Bill Clinton was asked the question, what is sex? And Bill Clinton's answer was, what is? And then he turns to the judge on CNN, and you had half of America watching this when he was on the witness stand. And he said to the judge, I just showed the American people a verb is and a noun is. Would you like me to show them another verb and another noun? And the judge stands up and says, there'll be no further questions, Mr. President. This court stands adjourned. And the entire trial is now suspended. And everybody's going, what was that? One question, no answer. So Bill calls me up that night. He says, well, that worked really good, Dave. He says, but what am I going to do when I go in front of the Senate? He says, I can't take my lawyers in with me. He says, and I have to answer their questions. I says, well, Bill, it says you're a lawyer. Bill Clinton was a lawyer, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, because he used a noun, is as a noun, he's lost his bar card. For 5 years, he was suspended because he created a fact. He violated the law of no law, no fact, and he established a fact on the witness stand. So therefore, they suspended him. I says, well, it says, Bill, remember the movie A Few Good Men with Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson? He goes, yeah. I says, remember when Nicholson took the stand? He says, you want the truth? You can't handle the truth, but I'm going to tell you the truth. Well, Bill walked into the Senate, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, he says, you want the truth? Well, I'm going to tell you the truth. Before we get started, he pulls out a $1 bill. He holds the $1 bill up and he says, ladies and gentlemen, you see that black line that runs around the edge of the $1 bill? He says, that makes a box. And under maritime law, boxing, it's an enclosed area and can't be considered. Now, if you look at all your newspapers and magazines, they all got boxes around all their private advertising.
Yeah,
because it's
true.
An enclosed area and you can't be considered. So then he says, remember when we went to school in fifth grade, ladies and gentlemen? We learned about prepositional phrases, and of was the preposition and the was the article. But when you take all the prepositions and all the articles in the English language and you separate them, they all become adverbs. Now, the adverb is a modifier. So an adverb can modify an adjective. So when you take the as the adverb and you put it in front of united, United ends in ED, so it's now in past tense. It doesn't have now time jurisdiction. And it's under the color of law, of the law. So therefore, because it's a color adjective, it now modifies the pronoun states. Now, the word pronoun, P-R-O means no, N-O means no, and U-N means no. It's Latin. So the pronoun has no authorization because it's been modified by the color and modified by the condition of thinking, adverbs and adjectives. Now, the of is now an adverb, and an adverb takes jurisdiction for the pronoun in front of it. But then it turns around and it modifies and changes and causes the action to take place of the dangling participle verb America. You want to show me the verb America in the dictionary?
Right.
Or when the federal government brings a lawsuit that says United States of America versus Joe Blow?
Well, there is no...
How does the verb America sue anything?
Yeah.
Ah, but you see, the people can't read and write. They don't teach this in school. They don't teach it in college. So therefore, nobody knows what's going on out there. The entire 300 million Americans are illiterate. They can't read and write because they didn't learn procedures of how communications are how communications function or how to write a correct sentence.
Yeah, can you explain how when you go into court and you help somebody, how they throw things out? I've heard all kinds of stories of things getting thrown out that might have been an actual crime committed, but it had to go away because they couldn't present it properly.
Right. I was in the Marfino case down out there in L.A. County, and I took the witness stand. This was in front of Judge... Mangerson. Judge Mangerson was the judge on that one. Federal District Court.
Okay.
IRS case. Man didn't pay taxes since 18. He was now 33. So
okay.
15 years he didn't pay taxes. The IRS was asking for $1.6 million in fines and 12 years in prison.
Okay.
So Frank put me up on the witness stand, and I said, wait a minute, before we get started here, District Attorney says, objection, Your Honor. Mr. Miller can't just start talking like that. He says, well, I've got to qualify the jury, sir, before I give testimony. Otherwise, they won't be able to understand what I'm saying. The judge says, Mr. Miller, you can't ask the questions to the jury. I says, well, how about if I ask you the question, Your Honor, and then you ask the jury the question? He says, the district attorney says, I object, Your Honor. This is highly irregular. Mr. Miller is not allowed to question the jury. He says, Mr. Miller, this question you want to ask me, is it so important that if I find it to be frivolous, you'll spend 6 months in jail? I says, yeah, I accept that contract. And the judge, Mangerson, says, well, obviously this question is so important that Mr. Miller is willing to spend 6 months in jail to have me ask the jury, so I'm going to go ahead and allow Mr. Miller to ask me that question. And the judge... Everybody's curiosity was really piqued.
Oh, yeah. Including mine.
So the judge had me whisper in his ear. And I whispered, does 2 + 2 = 4? The judge sat back in his chair for a minute and rubbed his chin. He goes, that's interesting. He says, I'll ask the jury that question. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I'd like to see a show of hands. Does 2 + 2 = 4? And all 12 hands go up. And then I spouted out and I says, does T-O plus T-O-O equal F-O-R? Does T-W-O and T-W-O equal F-O-R-E? Did you hear what I said, what I meant, what I said, when I said, what I meant, what I said? The district attorney jumps up and yells, objection, Your Honor. Mr. Miller's trying to make fun of the jury. I says, I'm trying to make fun of the jury. You're the one that wrote the word indictment. I space. N space D space I space and so on, and I says when you put a space between each letter, you break the continuance of evidence. I says so I now becomes an adverb modifying the N verb. I mean the N adjective. So you got an adverb modifying 8 adjectives, and then the T at the end becomes a pronoun. I says that doesn't spell indictment. You tricked the jury. You think that you had a word here. And that this was a criminal proceedings. I says, and you took every single word in your document, which came to over 4,300 mistakes, and you modified every single word with an adverb and an adjective, and you have not one single complete sentence. But then you went ahead and you tricked the judge here. and you tricked the jury through this fiasco. And then the IRS also filed papers and didn't use a single legal sentence and modified every single word with an adverb or an adjective to create pronouns and dangling participle verbs. I says, you don't have a single legal sentence. The IRS jumps up and says, Your Honor, we have no charges against Mr. Frank Maranfino. We hereby dismiss all credibility to this case here. We withdraw all charges against him. And the district attorney stands up and says, we concur with the district with the IRS. We have no charges against Mr. Maranfino. Judge says, well, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've been hoodwinked three times. You're disqualified as a jury. And ladies and gentlemen, because there's no charges here, Mr. Maranfino, you're free to go. And Mr. Miller, you get out of my courtroom right now. Throw me off the witness stand.
That's pretty amazing.
And as soon as I put my foot off the witness stand, he says, however, and I went to sit back down. He goes, no, he says, you're out of here. Bailiff, get this man out of my courtroom right now. So I left the courtroom. And they escorted me out, and I had to wait out in the hallway. But then the judge came back, and he said to Frank, he says, Frank, he says, what does this mean? He says, I don't know. He says, I copied it. Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12B1, you lack knowledge. Therefore, you committed perjury here today. 18 months for perjury.
Wow.
And he sat in jail for 18 months.
Who was that?
Didn't have any issues with the IRS, but he did commit perjury.
So who sat in jail?
Frank did.
Oh, okay.
See, if you're going to go into court and you're going to use in the truth language, you better know what you're doing. Don't get half a story or try and copy somebody else's ideas that you don't understand and then walk into a courtroom, because with a Missouri judge in 1997, we were winning cases from 1982 all the way through 1997, and finally a Missouri federal judge says, hey, would you please explain that to me? He said, that's very interesting what you said. And the guy says, I don't know, I copied it.
What?
And the judge says, oh, you lack 12B1 knowledge, therefore you're disqualified in this courtroom. Then he put him in jail. Then he sent a message through Lexis and Nexus, which is the internet for judges,
right,
and told all the judges in the United States, both state and federal, if they don't have knowledge, they don't qualify.
Which is true.
That's why you're called pro ses, ladies and gentlemen, when you walk into a courtroom without an attorney, because pro means no, and se is Latin for speak, no speak.
Wow.
If you speak an adverb verb, you're just talking to yourself.
That's amazing.
Now you've got a courtroom here, and you know something else? There's planes, P-L-A-N-E-S. There are planes in a courtroom. And like a playing field of a game, you have to have a level playing field, baseball, football, soccer, doesn't matter what it is. Anytime you have a contest, you must have a level playing field. But when you walk into a courtroom, you've got a jury box, which is an enclosed area, and they cannot be considered of any evidence or testimony. You have a witness box or the witness stand, and you are above and boxed in so your testimony can't be heard or seen because you're on a different plane. Both the prosecution and the defense, or the claimant and the respondent, are on the same level playing field. Well, guess who else is usually on that same level playing field? You got a bailiff, and you also got the clerk of the courts. The judge is in a box up on a level, a separate level, three steps above you. And because the judge is in a box, he's an actor under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 44.1. He's really not even in the courtroom because the flag he flies has four colors on it, or has a rope on it, which is maritime commerce, or has a phoenix on top or a spear on top of the flagpole. Do you know that anything you put on top of a flagpole captures the jurisdiction of the flag and cancels the whatever the contract of that flag means?
No, I had no idea.
Now you've got a man sitting up there in black robes. He's not even in the courtroom. And the clerk of the courts, who puts stamps on all the evidence, signs her names across the stamp, is called a postmaster. Another name for postmaster is a banker. And if you look up bankers, it says see judges. And if you look up judges, it says see postmasters and bankers.
That's amazing.
So what is the clerk of the court? She's the postmaster, a banker, and a judge.
Clerk has the power.
Well, she's the one that does all that signing.
Yeah.
You know, going all the way back to 1968, I was 18 years old. I took a trip out to Denver, Colorado, and on my way back, I got a speeding ticket. I was cutting through the cornfields in Nebraska. And here a cop pulls out right in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I was like 5 miles from the closest town or anything going through the cornfields. And he pulls me over and says, well, you were doing a little bit over the speed limit, 10 miles over the speed limit. I says, yeah, I was. I says, there's nobody around. He says, well, what happens if a cow steps out from the corn here and you run into it? He says, you're going to damage yourself. He says, I got to give you a speeding ticket. And I says, well, I says, yeah, I was speeding. So we went down. He says, you want to follow me down to the courthouse? And I says, yeah, sure. So I followed the cop. We drove for 3 miles. We got down this little intersection. It was this little corner store, 20 feet by 20 feet, grocery store. We walked in that grocery store, and here's a man standing behind the counter with a bib on, and he's ringing up some groceries for a lady. And the police officer walks in. He says, I got another one, Judge. He says, just wait a minute. I got to finish this. Well, because he's a grocer, he's practicing banking. He's taking money. He's giving receipts. He's exchanging commerce.
Right.
So as soon as the lady packed up her bag, she got ready to leave, and he says, no, stay here. I need a witness. So then he takes off his apron, and he puts on his black robe, pulls a little podium up from underneath the counter and grabs his gavel and says, court's in session.
Right in the court.
What's the charge? And I'm going, I was speeding. And he says, well, $100 fine. He says, or 30 days in county jail. And we'll sell your car to pay for your stay in jail because we're not going to feed you and house you for nothing. He says, well, okay, well, I got $100 on me, so I paid the judge. Well, when I paid the judge the $100 fine, he's practicing banking.
Right.
So he gives me a receipt for the $100, just like he did for the groceries.
Right.
And he says, court's, and another lady come walking in, and she started talking. And says, you're out of order. Court's in session. Stand there, you're a witness. So that lady stood there. He concluded the business with me, and he says, now court's adjourned. Bang. Then she perks up as soon as the judge said court's adjourned. He says, I need some stamps. So he hangs up his black robe, slides over 2 feet, opens the little 2 foot window, which is the local post office for that county, puts on his postmaster's hat and says, and starts selling stamps. Again, a postmaster conducting banking and commerce.
Right.
So at the age of 18, I witnessed a postmaster, banker, and judge all standing in one position. And because it's a little county of a few hundred people, he held all three titles.
Right.
Well, later, when I turned 50 years old, I learned about that position when I became a judge. And so that's why on my business cards, it says on there, postmaster, banker, and judge.
Yeah, right.
Because it's the judge of the United States of our world corporation, which I might add, we have over 200 million members worldwide with 245,000 linked websites to my website.
I know.
People are studying. They download a million minutes a day of information off my website, and over 30 to 40,000 new students a day log on to my website. We have caller ID. We can track this.
Wow. We're going to bring one of your students on in a minute. I have a question. Tell people about the Title 42 lawsuit and the Art Bell show, Art Bell's son.
Art Bell's son, I was doing programming with Art Bell. We did about 8 shows together, explaining about how to sue judges, that they're not immune from prosecution, how to construct the sentences so that you have enforcement. Now, when you sign a document, and this is relevant to the show issue, when you sign a document, you always sign it at the bottom because it has your autograph has jurisdiction for everything in front of it and above it.
Okay,
now, the first thing that an individual says when a police officer or a judge, where they believe violated their rights, they say, the judge did. And thou is an adverb making judge a verb. There's no such thing as a verb judge. And number two, the judge, the word judge is responsible for everything in front of it, which was the adverb the, which means nothing. So he was always immune from nothing because nothing was ever placed in front of him.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So when Art Bell's situation came up, Art called me up. He says, you know, because of the programming I'm doing, they can't get me because I'm a public announcer. So they went after my son, and they got these trumped-up charges against him. He wasn't even in the same area when this all took place. But they're assigning it to him to get at me and told me if I get off the air, they'll drop the charges against him. So we went ahead and I wrote a sentence for Art Bell's son to read in court. For this witness's knowledge of the facts are with the claim of the damage with the fictitious conveyance of the language under Title 18, Section 1001 and 1002, with the modification of using adverbs and adjectives in front of the nouns to turn them into verbs and pronouns, and by doing so, I am damaged by the judge. Now, the judge is responsible for everything in front of his name.
Right, in the courtroom.
Now, the judge is supposed to be responsible to protect the citizens, right?
That's correct.
So is the city attorney or the district attorney in federal court. And these attorneys are supposed to be protecting we the people. Well, you know what? That phrase, we the people, that isn't what it exactly says, like on the Constitution. We is a pronoun, does an adverb, modifying the people verb. You feel like a verb today? Or how about we, and you're all thinking to yourself, we, the population of the United States, 300 million people, are pronouns? And pro means no, and no means no, and UN means no. So we're all no-nos. So we got a situation here with language. And by making that statement, the judge says, I want to join with the court. And I want to see the law written in the truthful communications. I want to see the oath in the truthful communications. I want to see the charges in the truthful communications. The judge says, well, we don't have any case dismissed.
Wow. The judge takes
just like that. Now, here's two secrets for everybody. Pay close attention. Anytime the vowel A, E, I, O, or U are used as a single syllable to start a word, it means no contract. That word means no contract. Anytime a vowel is followed by two consonants, when a vowel starts the word, that word means no contract. Like attorney, ATT, no contract, because everything they write is adverb verb. There's no correct sentence, so therefore there's no contract. Or the word art, A-R-T, is just an illusion, I-L-L, placed on canvas of what a person believes is in his mind. But the contract is no more unique to the individual who created it than the opinion, O being a single vowel, which means no contract of the opinion of thinking, so therefore you have a no contract opinion because it's only of one. And they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and you look at a picture and 1,000 people will give you 1,000 definitions because it is their own one thought. And you need two or more to make corporation. You need two or more to make a contract because one must be offered and another one must accept it. Otherwise, you have opinion. Now, how about the phrase, the United States? The judge says, I swear to support the United States. Or he says, he takes an oath. And in his oath, he says, I support the Constitution of the United States. That's his oath. And everyone's walking in there with this document that was written on September 17, 1789. And judge says, I don't know what you're talking about. You can't bring that into this courtroom. That's got nothing to do with what goes on in here. Thomas Jefferson wrote that. And he was trained by Benjamin Franklin, who was a triple agent working for the English. He was a French attorney working for the English crown to capture the United States.
There's a lot of stuff about Benjamin Franklin.
Since I've been talking about this here, there's been a few people did some research using the language, and they said, yeah, this guy was a triple agent.
Well, I've heard that before, actually. I'm pretty aware.
And
also, explain a little bit about the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence that we had that conversation with. That was pretty
cool. Okay. Well, let me finish the Constitution.
Yeah.
Now, the judge swears an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. And like I told Mr. Bell here in our last conversation, when the two of us are in the same room together, we have two people. So therefore, he's a condition of state and I'm a condition of state. Together, we're the United States. And a courtroom is a closed area. What do you do in a courtroom? You have a trial. You know what the synonym of trial is? Experiment. EX means no. Apparement, which is contract. It's a no-contract trial because everyone speaks an adverb verb. There are no oaths. There are no rules. There are no regulations, and you're in a box. So he supports the Constitution of the United States, but the synonym of Constitution is contract. So it's a contract between two people that wish to argue about something. And the arbitrator, because he can't get involved with perjury, sets himself up in a box on a plane outside of the two people they're going to argue, but they don't know they're on a different plane. They don't know that the argument is going to be an adverb verb because they can't read and write.
That's amazing. It's true, though.
Yes. And so the United States is no more than the two people in the contract they brought into court, and up until the time I did my quantum language, 100% of communication skills in 8,500 years and in 5,000 languages in 250 countries on this planet have been modified. And I've done research, and I can't find a single legal sentence anywhere in the history of mankind in any language, and I've just spent 68,000 hours looking for it.
That's amazing.
I write mathematically correct sentences.
Well, I proved that. Question. One of the things we mentioned, because I want to cover some other things right in the same area, that's like, when you go into a court anywhere in the United States, they pretty much have a picture of you somewhere in there. Is that true or not?
Yes. All the judges in the United States, all 11,000, have been issued a portfolio on me, so they have my picture. Some of the courtrooms, the judges hang my picture in their judges' chambers so that they know when I walk in, because I've been in 330 cities in the past 7 years. And I pop up in these courtrooms everywhere. I mean, I move very fast. I move around. I walk in the court. I help people. And so they never know when I'm going to show up. Even in the little backwater country courthouses in the middle of the Rocky Mountains where you'd never think I'd show up, I'll pop up.
That's pretty neat.
And they know who I am when I walk in the door.
Yeah. And so when you start talking about these conditions of the language, they have but no choice to listen to you, because if they challenge you, then they're going to have a real problem, I would say.
Well, when I go into court, as long as I sit in the peanut gallery, I'm not in the bar. I don't cross the bar. Most judges won't allow me inside the bar.
Right.
And like, it was 2 years ago in November, I was in Los Angeles there in a trial, and the city was going to take this man's house. And he asked me to come to court with him, and he called me up as a witness. And it was a 110-page lawsuit that the city attorney had filed against this man to take his house. And he had been to court 9 times in 1 year already, and this was supposed to be the final hearing to take the man's house. So I went ahead, and I entered the bar, and I says, I'm Judge David Wynn Miller. And the judge goes, are you really a judge? And I goes, yes, I am. He says, where'd you get your judgeship? I says, in Hawaii. I says, the Kapunas elected me as the first king since 1893 when I wrote the apology bill, and we filed that at the World Court. And the World Court ruled that the Hawaiian people are now sovereign because the United States used Nam de Guerre names on the homeland's water rights and housing rights in 1929. 1919 in Hawaii. And it took 20 years before they got everybody's signature to sign up for this $1 a year for housing. for the Capunas. So in 1939, they had 100% of the people all in uppercase spelling nom de guerre. And 20 years after that, on August 25th, 1959, President Eisenhower stands up and says, all Hawaiians are dead. We now see the Hawaiian Islands as the 50th state of the United States, which then angered the Hawaiians, and they went ahead and they sued in federal district court in adverb verb going all the way up to 1996. And I went to Hawaii and I sat down. And there's a tale, was a prophecy made in 1859 by King Kamehameha. It said a white man with a bird will come from America, and he will set the Hawaiian people free. And when I came to Hawaii, I went to Maui after doing one of my seminars, and I met with 12 of the Kapunas on Maui. And a wild sparrow flew out of a palm tree and landed on my index finger of my right hand and sat there for 2 hours and 45 minutes. While I had a meeting with the Kapunas, and in that I explained to them, they showed me these treaties that they had signed. I says, well, your names are in nom de guerre. It means you're dead. And according to the treaty, if you're dead on paper, you surrender your land, and whoever files claim against it now owns it. And I sat down and wrote a 7-page Title 42 lawsuit for wrongful contract. And for under maritime law of closure, the United States government did not give closure that they were going to use a nom de guerre name to capture all the Hawaiian people and then declare them dead to take their land. The World Court ruled that because they failed to give closure to the secret intent of their act of these contracts, that all the contracts that the United States had laid claim to with the Hawaiians was now null and void, and the Hawaiians were all free. So President Clinton had to apologize to the Hawaiians for this trickery. That's when Clinton and I first had contact with each other on language issues, and then after that he had his trial.
Wow, that's amazing. And then I guess you worked also, I'm just trying to cover this before I bring money on, you worked with the Vatican?
We wrote some banking treaties. We're about 110 pages long. We went over to the Vatican and we served those on the Vatican about the fact that the Vatican supports the World Bank, but their contracts are all written in adverb verb. And when they saw our treaties in that, it changed everything. It caused quite a stir in the international banking community.
Especially with them being the source of a Latin language, which is the root of the language somewhere.
We're still under Roman law here in the United States after 2,000 years.
Wow. And then also you also work with the UN to set up treaties.
I've been to the UN a total of 21 days on three different visits, and I've served, these were international trade treaties dealing with international constitutions written in quantum language. So they had a format of how to communicate between each other, and we got treaties with 83 countries. You know that of the 83 countries, not one of them knew about their own flags?
That's
the fact
amazing.
That they had yellow fringe, all 83 countries. As a matter of fact, all 199 countries at the UN have yellow fringe flags flying. They have gold braids on their flags. And some have spears and some have eagles on their flagpoles.
Right.
And they weren't even aware of what that meant.
Wow.
And when they looked at what their constitution of their country represented as to what the flag was on their constitution, they realized at that point, just like in the United States here, our flag has three colors, red, white, and blue.
Correct.
But then when you go into a post office, you have a red, white, and blue, and yellow. When you go into a courtroom, you have red, white, and blue, and yellow. You have a four-colored flag. That's not an American flag. That's an Army regulation flag under 840-10, Chapter 2-3. It says that military flags can use yellow fringe.
Interesting.
But you're in the courtroom, and we're not in the military. So what are we doing in the military court-martial? And just about every courtroom I've been in, they put a spear on top of the state flag, which makes it a state militia court if it's a state issue.
Wow. So this is all the kind of stuff you teach in your classes, right?
Yes. I'm showing people the procedures by which the government under... Now, this is maritime law worldwide. You must advertise your contract in order to have jurisdiction? Well, they advertise they're going to use a fiction flag, and they're going to talk in fiction language. And because you walked, you know, look up the word law of the flag. If you don't wish to make contract under this flag, don't enter my vessel. Do you know that all courthouses in the United States are vessels in dry dock, and the judges are paid by the port authorities, and the port authorities are controlled by the Department of Transportation, and the Department of Transportation is owned by the post office, which is responsible for the bills of lading and controls the treasury, and only postmasters are allowed to appear on the money. Who's on the $100 bill?
Exactly.
Benjamin Franklin.
Exactly.
First Postmaster General of the United States. What's the decimal point for one? 1.00, 100.
Yeah.
Grant was Postmaster General during the Civil War, who then became President of a country divided in one half. What's the decimal point for one half? 0.50. Who's on the 50? Grant.
For him.
Lincoln's only was a letter carrier, so he's only one-tenth as important. So he's on the $5 bill, because the one was taken up already.
That's amazing.
Jackson was the second president, the second Postmaster General, who now got put on the $2 bill. And then you got Lincoln was on the penny because he was the first letter carrier who became a president of the second international bankruptcy.
Wow.
Which was 1859. See, the first one was on September 17, 1789. And an international bankruptcy runs for 70 years. And the Bank of England backed the United States currency. That's why we had money. When the bankruptcy ended, the United States announced that they weren't going to renew it. So the North said to the South, we want you to finance us. You got gold, silver, tobacco, and cotton. And we're poor up here in the North. And the South says, no, we're leaving. So the North says, well, I guess we're going to renew the bankruptcy. You give us the money, we'll buy the builder a war machine, and we'll go down there and conquer the South, take the gold and the silver and pay off the debt, and we'll end the bankruptcy. England said that's fine, except the war lasted 6 years and bankrupted both the North and the South. So the bankruptcy ran for another 70 years to 1929.
Wow.
So the United States said, we're not going to renew our bankruptcy again. On November 2nd, that's when we elect our pre-simulation denture, better known as the president, of the bankruptcy trust. So England had to give, under maritime law, which was established in 1906, had to give a five-day notice. Subtract 5 days from November 2nd, which is Election Day, and you get October 29th, 1929, stock market crashes.
Wow.
So the United States again renewed the bankruptcy for another 70 years to November 2nd, 1999. Did we elect a president on that day? Nope. They had us counting ballots because at the stroke of midnight, on November 2nd, 1999, the Congress, the Senate, the legislature, and the United States Supreme Court all voted to end the bankruptcy because MasterCard controlled 99 cents on a dollar for all debts in the United States.
Oh.
The computer age was here running everything. And the bankruptcy officially ended. The stock market, I think, traded at five points that day on the upside. But did we elect a president? No, they had us counting ballots. Two-thirds of all the states had to recount their ballots under the two-thirds rule. No law in federal law becomes legal for 90 days. Notice I said the word no law. That's because there are no laws. So for the next 90 days, they had everybody counting ballots. The Congress, the Senate, the legislature, and the Supreme Court knew that on February 2nd, 2000, that Bush, with 47% of the vote, would be the next 47th president in a row that uses his left hand to sign things. He's left-handed.
Right.
What are the odds of having 47 consecutive left-handed presidents in a row? See, that one, Las Vegas wouldn't even give you odds on that.
No, they wouldn't.
February 2nd, 2000, the United States of America Corporation was formed. And the United States Post Office laid claim to all water rights in the United States above and below ground. And because water is life.
Right. Now, I have a question.
Yes.
We know that martial law pretty much has been declared because of this this fake terrorist thing that's going on that's been created. How would you define martial law as it stands in this country today?
Okay, the president can only declare martial law for 90 days. That means every 90 days he must either leave the country for 24 hours so the vice president can go ahead and reissue the martial law for that one day, come back in when the vice president's 90-day law ends, then because the president's still in the country, he can renew it so it only appears once every 6 months he leaves the country. Or the last time when the 90-day cycle came up, he had to go in for a checkup and be put to sleep because there was some health thing. And if a president is put to sleep, the vice president has to be sworn in as a new president. So that's how they've been playing leapfrog every 90 days to keep the martial law issue alive.
Yeah, and what about these Homeland Security Acts and all this? These funny laws.
That's all part of the hopscotch.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, pretty much.
How'd you like to know about the World Trade Center? Or have you seen my?
Tell us about that. That's a subject we've been covering pretty actively at BBS Radio. Yeah.
Okay. 1 year on the anniversary, September 11th, 2002, I was in Texas, and I did a live TV show for an hour. And I went out in 11 states on national TV, and I explained what happened at the World Trade Center. And they've got you looking at two airplanes flying into the building. Everybody watched that on television.
Correct.
And they kept everybody busy pointing the finger at all these terrorists. Well, if you look at the close videotape, there's no windows on the two planes that hit the building.
But we know that, yes. That's
and so the planes that took off with all those passengers, they probably were out in the Atlantic Ocean about 300 miles when they went into the water. But in spite of everything that we watched, there's one thing that everybody watched, but nobody actually realized what happened. Now, my background is in metallurgy. When you study metallurgy, you study the coefficient of expansion of metals, gases, crystals. And what is the World Trade Center made out of? They're made out of three things, concrete, steel, and glass.
Exactly.
Okay, the coefficient of expansion of concrete, steel, and glass is all the same, 6.3. That's why you can use it to build a building. Because it all contracts and expands at the same rate, therefore it's incorporated with each other. Now, plastic also has the coefficient of expansion of 6.3. C4 plastic, when it is detonated, creates an electromagnetic pulse that only affects one molecule, a 6.3 molecule.
Interesting.
So if you go ahead and you put C4 in the World Trade Center, and you detonate it, you'll create an electromagnetic pulse that will change gravity. Now, the unique thing is that the World Trade Center, both of them, are 1,300 feet tall. If you were to, and if anyone out there listening knows anything about acceleration of a falling object is 33 feet per second compounded. So it's 33, 96, 99, 132, and so on. That means it takes 12 seconds for the top of the World Trade Center to hit the ground. You know the World Trade Center fell down in 4.8 seconds?
That's kind of bad.
Hello?
Yeah, and how does the World Trade Center get down in 4.8 seconds when gravity says it can't get down in less than 12 seconds? That means somebody changed the gravity.
Hello, folks. I hate to interject. I really do. I was hoping that we could run this a little later, this show, because it's, I mean, wow, what a powerful show. And you have a ton of listeners on here, and I know why, because it's just a fabulous show. But we have James Gilliland doing a conference, a UFO conference in Hawaii. And he has a bunch of speakers there from around the world that have gathered there that are going to be on his radio program here coming up next. So I kind of have to be on time with his show. And I apologize for being a little late on this show. We started about 4 minutes late. So
yeah, because I wanted to bring Monty on, and he can explain. He's actually gone into court and practiced some of the stuff.
Well, we might, if you want to, we can reschedule this for right after James's show, and hopefully we can. I'll see. I'll have to talk to the other host. We might be able to do a late show. If, in fact,
well, what I'd rather do, Don, is just continue this show. This show was so good that
I know.
We can continue this show a couple weeks from now.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I mean, I'd love to be able to continue it if you guys want to continue it. Maybe tomorrow or the next day. We can find
I don't
time.
Know if that's possible. I think I'd rather probably go a week or so and reschedule this and reset this up because.
And maybe we can set it up during a time where we give it a few hours.
Yeah, it's up. What do you think, Judge Miller? Are you having?
Yeah, I can. I got 400 hours of material, so if you want to do 2 hours is nothing.
Yeah, well, what we'll do is I want to have you on again real soon because, and Monty, and I apologize to Monty because he's got one thing that I was unfortunate we're not going to be able to do is bring him on because this is a student of Judge Miller's, and this student has done some amazing things, and he's just now studying all this. His students are very effective in the courtroom. That's something that I'm sure the audience is going to be very interested in hearing about. So we'll schedule this for a few weeks from now, and I'll set this all up, and we'll continue on. And you're going to have this archived anyway pretty soon, right, Don, so they can hear the first part. We'll call this part one.
Absolutely. My brother's been listening to your show with enrapture. I mean, he just is stunned. I got to tell you, one powerful show. I'm so delighted to be able to bring this to the listeners.
Well, when you got a person on the network on BBS Radio that's got his face in every courtroom in America, I think you'd say, here comes the judge.
I would have to say you're correct. Yes.
I tried for 4 months to get this.
I would have to say he's definitely a friend.
He's a good man to know. The next time you get in trouble, you might want to have one of his students come and bail you out. Because they can do it. I've seen it done.
Well, hey, again, folks, you heard it. He said we're going to be, Dr. Bell's going to be bringing back the judge quite a number of times, and we will keep you posted, and I will put some spreads up on the index page to let all you listeners know when they're going to be, what times, so that you will have advanced notice. So keep checking BBS Radio.
All right, Judge, and I'll contact you next week, and we'll set up another time. And I really, really thank you from the bottom of my heart and all my listeners. I think this is one of the best shows we've ever had on this network since it started a year ago.
I agree.
Well,
yeah, thank you. You are an awesome person. And I'll tell you what, having had several conversations with Monty, and I have seen the fruition of your work, and that is what's even more amazing. That's why I'm so enthralled to have you and one of your students on, because I've seen what your students do. So it's not what you're saying. I see it happening. You're amazing. We need more people on the planet like you, Judge Miller. We really do.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for being on.
All right. You have a good evening.
Bye. So this has been Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. And I hope that you'll tune in for the next one. Thank you.